It is 6:14, first day of October. There's a little bit of weather in the Gulf. Might cause some rain for us later in the week. Honestly, they don't know. I don't know what to tell you because they don't know. They don't know. I think it's one of these things where maybe back in the day when we didn't have all of this technology, maybe we wouldn't have even known about it. So maybe we wouldn't have even had to worry about it. Or maybe we don't have to worry about it now. Again, they don't know. So I don't know what to tell you other than it might rain later on in the week and then maybe on later on this weekend. A couple of stories in the Atlantic this month, I guess it comes out, hypocrisy, spinelessness, and the triumph of Donald Trump. Does not blast Donald Trump. What that does is it talks about so many Republicans that were never Trumpers that completely flipped. And if you read the story, you'll see quotes from Donald Trump, how he makes fun of them for doing that, how he predicted this in 2016, how he was going to bring the Republican Party to its knees, how they were going to cower to him, and that's exactly what happened. That being said, the vice presidential debate is tonight. One of the people taking part in it is J.D. Vance, his vice presidential candidate, candidate who was a never-Trumper at one point. David Schultz joins us now, professor of political science at Hamline University. How you doing, David?
I am doing great, and I hope you're doing well.
I'm well. Did you read that story or not in The Atlantic?
I did read that story. Yes, I did. And it seems to me that one of the if what truth is the first casualty of politics, I guess the second casualty is probably what consistency or something like that. And it just seems like maybe it's worse now than it used to be. I don't know. You know, but the fact that you have people like, you know, you have Vance, you have Haley, you know, who during the primary, you know, basically, you know, hammered Trump about being what, unqualified, et cetera, et cetera. Vance did the same thing. And then you have people, take us back, 4 years ago, you have Mitch McConnell during the second impeachment trial, you know, who is strongly critical also of Trump. And then all these people line up right behind him.
Lindsey Graham, if I can phrase this delicately, if Trump were to ever stop short, Lindsey Graham would disappear. If you get my meaning on that.
I do.
Okay.
I do.
Because and Trump, to his credit, he predicted this back in 2016 that he would have these people cowering to him and kissing his ring or anything else. And he's even called these politicians out on stage and said, I think it was Lindsey Graham, I don't want to misquote anything from the article here, but that he wants my nomination or he wants a nomination, so he's kissing my A. On stage, he says this about these people in front of him, and they continue to kiss his A, which is interesting. Let's talk about the vice presidential debate tonight. Some people are saying it matters. Some people say it doesn't. Your thoughts?
For the most part, vice presidential debates really don't matter at the end of the day. Again, people are voting for the president of the United States. And generally, again, like I said, they don't matter. The first rule of vice presidential debates is do no harm. Don't make any major mistakes, of which now, tomorrow in tomorrow's paper, they'll be highlighting that. And of course, if you think of major mistakes in terms of president or vice presidential debates, you have to go back 30 years ago to Dan Quayle, Lloyd Benson, with Quayle comparing himself to JFK and Benson just flattening him, you know, on that. So first, make no mistake. And then two, at that point, it's what? Defend your president, make the points you want to make, try to humiliate the other side. But generally, they don't matter. But maybe, just maybe this year, in an election so close where moving 1,000 people here, 1,000 people there might matter, maybe it matters a little bit, but it'll mostly be, I don't know, maybe a good show just to watch tonight. You know, it's like entertainment, I'll call it. Yeah.
That's what it seems like to me. It seems like a what do you call them? What's the new thing? WWE? Is that wrestling? What is the new wrestling federation?
Yeah. Is that World Wrestling Federation? Yeah. Something? I can't remember. WWF, something like that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
That's what it seems like to me, where it's going to be interesting to watch. Maybe it's real, you know, maybe it's not, but I don't think it's going to change one mind at all. I really don't. I guess you could look at it from the standpoint of one of these people could wind up being president. You never know. Actuarially speaking, you would think that would mean that Vance would have a better, and again, this is nothing to do with partisanship or anything else. It's just insurance companies and age and actuarial tables that you would think it would be more of a concern when you talk about Vance or Trump, but I don't think people are going to make that connection. Do you?
I don't think so either. I mean, possibly if it was still Biden versus Trump, you know, maybe given the fact that an 82-year-old versus a 78-year-old, maybe it would have been on more people's minds. But I really just don't think so. I also don't think tonight we're going to hear very much in terms of serious depth or policy. That there'll be probably the two or three talking points that each side wants to make, and then there'll be the two or three talking points they want to use to attack the other side. And I think really the question that we're going to look to see tonight is if and how quickly does it degenerate into personal attacks? Because I think that's what a lot of people are expecting at this point, is that it's going to turn ugly. If it helps at all, you know, because Waltz is the governor of Minnesota where I live. The last debate that he did when he was running for governor against Dr. Jensen, I was a medical doctor a couple of years ago, was incredibly ugly. I mean, within minutes, it was just flinging insults back and forth. And so
Waltz?
Waltz, yeah. Who's my governor, right, in Minnesota. So listen and remember, I know a lot about Waltz, you know, because he's my governor for the last 6 years. And Vance is known for also being able to, you know, to fling insults. And so going back to the wrestling, I guess, parallel here, you know, how quickly before, I don't know, somebody, you know, I'm trying to say, I'm not a wrestling fan myself, but how quickly before somebody throws somebody else on the mat or whatever like that? That's what I'm sort of wondering tonight.
A metal folding chair comes out of nowhere and slaps somebody, all of a sudden Donald Trump appears. He appears in the wings and rips off his jacket and shows his muscular frame and then starts throwing punches. And then maybe I'm getting a little carried away here, but anyway, let's take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We're talking about the vice presidential debate, which is going to be a show, I think. And I don't know if anybody's going to change your mind. One thing we'll talk about is military records when we come back. And my military record is better than yours, or I'm more of a soldier than you are. We'll talk about that as well. 621 traffic now, WWL. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to David Schultz, our friend, professor of political science at Hamline University, about the presidential race and the vice presidential debate that's going to happen tonight. Caroline Giuliani, Rudy Giuliani's daughter, endorsed Kamala Harris. She says, Donald Trump took my dad from me. Please don't let him take our country, too. Who knows what's going on with the family dynamic there? But the question I want to know, asking you, David, is, do endorsements matter, whether they come from within the family, outside of the family, within the party, outside of the party?
Now, the evidence is, if we look at it over time, like if we're talking about celebrity endorsements or any type of endorsements, probably marginal at best. You know, that is, and I'm going to say, even if they did in the past, this election, I don't think they matter whatsoever. That the electorate is so polarized, so locked into what their preferences are at this point. One of the things that's been really fascinating this year is people kept looking for all these so-called bumps, a convention bump or an assassination bump or debate bump. And there's been no real meaningful bumps whatsoever. And I just think it's because people have been so locked into their views at this point that there's practically nobody to persuade or move at this point. And it's really just going to come down to, you know, who gets off their butt and off the couch, you know, on election day and shows up to vote, you know. But in terms of, do you know anybody who's truly saying, gosh, I don't know if I'm going to vote for Trump or Harris. I'm truly undecided at this point. I don't know either. Minds are made up at this point. It's just like I said, are they going to get up and go out and vote at this point?
There's no exit polling on early voting or anything like that, right? So we have no idea what's going on with early voting?
We don't at this point. We know it's taking place in several states. We don't have any really good indication at this point at how heavy it is. Now, clearly 4 years ago, we were in the middle of the pandemic and it was incredibly heavy. But here we just don't have an indication on it. But you're raising, I want to bring up an interesting point here, is that looking at one of the so-called swing states this year is North Carolina. And as we know, unfortunately, and we have, you know, parts of North Carolina, you know, the western parts were just devastated by the hurricane. And the question now becomes, what impact might that hurricane have in terms of voting? Because that's also areas of the country which are more likely to vote Republican. So this the hurricane, you know, 30 days down the line here, and we still have to go before the election, could have an impact on that state and on that election.
You know, and again, I'm seeing different things about the response and Trump saying one thing, the White House saying the other thing. And I got to believe that the White, and I'm not, look, taking sides here, but I got to believe that the White House would be woefully negligent, is considering it's North Carolina, not to give every bit of help that they could to whatever state needed it, depending upon, you know, if the right declarations were made and the mm-hmm. right request and the right paperwork was filled in and all of that stuff. So, again, does that change anything, or does everybody believe what they want about that, about the response?
Everybody's going to believe what they want to believe at this point. I mean, there just seems to be nothing that's moving anybody at this point. And if I am like a television station at this point in one of the swing states, I'm thrilled to death, you know, that people have dumped in hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, in advertising, you know, that I can, so basically our revenue goes up for the year. But at some point, the advertising also is wasted. It's like carpet bombing in the States. It's saturation. Again, I don't think it's changing anybody, people's minds. One of my friends in Pennsylvania said to me, he'll be thrilled to see a car ad on television again after Election Day. And if you sort of get the drift of where he's going at this point, he's just like, I've made up my mind. I don't need to see any more ads.
Does there ever come a point where it is a negative, where people say, that's it, if I hear, and I get that way sometimes in local elections, yeah, where I say to myself, I swear to God, if I hear one more election, if I get one more text, I'm not going to vote for you.
Yeah, I think that's the issue at this point. If, given the fact they're so negative and each side is attacking the other, it might take those few undecided voters that are out there and just say, well, the heck with both of you, I'm just not going to vote for anybody on Election Day.
All right, thanks. I appreciate your time, David. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Jan Moeller about the looming budget deficit. Right now, time for WWL First News. 644, 16 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Jan Moeller joins us now, Executive Director of Investland Louisiana. Good morning, Jan. How are you?
I'm great. Good morning to you, Tommy.
Somebody texted in and said, a flat tax is the way to go. The more you spend, the more you pay in taxes. The less you spend, the less you pay in taxes. Can't get any more fair than that. That's what that person from the last four digits of 9418 thinks. Thoughts?
Well, if you pass a flat tax in Louisiana, and I think that's what Governor Landry is going to propose, it comes at a huge cost to state government. We estimate that it would cost about $1.1 billion in lost revenue. So if you want to have a flat tax, Tommy, then you're also going to have a lot of cuts to the budget. And we're already starting to see, because the legislature is already having hearings on the budget, what those would look like. And there's talk about closing campuses in the community and technical college system. There's talk of health care cuts. There's talk of all kinds of programs and services that I think people expect state government to provide, which they wouldn't be able to provide. So I think a flat tax sounds great to a lot of people, but it comes at a huge cost to the services that people expect.
Well, the texter said the more you spend, the more you pay in taxes, but the flat tax, he's talking about a flat income tax, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it has nothing to do with spending. The state has a personal income tax. 42 states have a personal income tax. Some states don't, of course. We always hear about Florida and Texas. But yeah, you pay a percentage of your income to the state. And the way Louisiana and most states do it, that income tax is progressive. So you pay a low rate on the first, say, $12,000, $15,000 you make, then you pay another rate on as your income goes up, and then you pay a top rate on your highest income. So it only applies to income above a certain level. That's called a progressive tax system. That's what we have in Louisiana, although ours isn't very high. We have very low income taxes overall. But what I think the governor is going to propose maybe this week, you know, we haven't seen his exact plan. We've seen some PowerPoints and ideas thrown out there, is to come to lower personal income taxes even more. And I think people have to understand Louisiana's income taxes are already among the lowest in the entire country, among the states that have a personal income tax. So if you want to go with a flat tax, what you're talking about is taking one of the lowest income taxes in the country, making it even lower, And then as a consequence, you either have to raise taxes somewhere else. And I think the governor is going to propose sales taxes going up, where Louisiana is already the highest in the country, one of the highest in the entire country. And if you're not going to be willing to raise taxes somewhere else, then you're really looking at deep cuts to the state budget.
So when it comes to this flat tax that you're expecting the governor to propose, who would benefit most? Who would get hurt the most?
It's easy. The people at the very top, the wealthiest Louisianans, and I think in the top 1%, you have to have a net taxable income of more than $683,000. The average income of people in the top 1% is about $1.1 million. If you're in that top 1%, the flat tax proposal that's out there would save you about $10,000 a year in state income taxes. If you're somewhere in the middle, you might save about $200, $250 a year. So I think everybody would save a little bit under this proposal. And so I think it sounds great to a lot of people, but I think you also have to calculate what services are you going to lose and what taxes are going to go up somewhere else. You know, when people raise the sales tax, for example, you don't notice it in the same way you notice the income tax because you pay it every time you buy something. So that's that. Again, we haven't seen the governor's plan yet. We're waiting to see that. It could come out as early as today. We know the governor has been talking to legislators, talking to people. His revenue secretary has been out and about the state talking about this idea, but we haven't seen a concrete plan. We haven't really seen yet how the numbers are going to, and so that's going to be a key thing for us to see, and really I think a lot of legislators are going to want to see that before they decide whether this is something they want to sign on to and whether they want to meet in a special session. Of course, you probably heard the governor's plan as of now is to have the legislature come in after the November 5th election, but before Thanksgiving in a special session to do a lot of these things. For some reason, he wants to get this done in November instead of waiting for the regular session that's happening in April.
Now, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Jan Moeller, Executive Director of Invest Louisiana, about this fiscal cliff. We'll talk about what's leading to that and again, what can be cut, what can't be cut, what it's likely to look like if it goes through. Somebody texted in and said, stop the wasteful spending. And we'll talk about that as well, Jan, about what can, where budget cuts can be made, where they can't, and what's going to be hurt, et cetera. 6:50, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:55, 5 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about the looming fiscal cliff. Somebody texted in and said, why is it that it's always the citizens that have to adjust their spending, but then the government never has to adjust their spending to make ends meet? I think the corollary to that text is, while inflation affects everybody, it also affects government spending as well. And that brings us, Jan Moeller, I guess, Executive Director of Louisiana, of Invest in Louisiana, to when it comes to cutting government spending and the Louisiana Constitution and flat tax and what's likely to be hurt, what they can cut and what they can't, right?
Absolutely. And look, state government is not like the federal government, where if you take in less revenue than you need to run the government, you just put it all on the credit card. The state can't run deficits, so the state has to balance its budget every year. Every budget that comes out of Baton Rouge in June is balanced against the revenue that's coming in. The problem is the legislature, you know, created this fiscal cliff because they can't seem to agree on a tax structure for very long. So the legislature created this problem for itself. And frankly, it's not Jeff Landry's fault. Jeff Landry didn't create this problem. The legislature created it in 2018 when they passed a tax package that had some temporary taxes on the books, a temporary sales tax, a temporary tax on business utilities. And they made the decision to shift some dollars out of the state general fund that's going to go into the transportation trust fund. You put those three, you know, tax cuts that are taking effect next year together, you get about a little over $500 million shortfall. And that's what's causing the budget to have to be cut. And the way that we've structured the budget is there's a lot of money that's locked away in the Constitution, or money that you kind of, even if it's not locked in the Constitution, it's money you have to spend. For example, corrections. You know, if you're going to put somebody in jail, it costs a certain amount of money to guard them and feed them and keep the lights on in the prisons. So that's considered kind of non-discretionary money. When you take all that off the table, that leaves you with health care, education, and social services. And so that's where the cuts come. And on the education side, it's really mostly in higher education, because the money we spend on public schools is part of those constitutional dedications. So that's why you very quickly start looking at these services that serve people with very low incomes, you know, medically fragile children, and higher education in particular. And when we're talking about cuts to higher education, readers have to understand colleges, when they get cut by the state, they just raise tuition and fees. So what you're really talking about there is pushing costs onto students and families, for people who just want to go to college, get an education, or maybe get a certificate so they can go work somewhere.
So Richard Nelson and the governor say this is the way to go, that it's going to attract more business to Louisiana, and as a result, it's going to attract more jobs. What do you say to that?
Well, that's the theory, at least. Again, if having low taxes was the key to bringing business in, we'd already have all the business we need, because Louisiana is already a pretty low tax state. So I think, you know, the other side of that coin is you bring in business and you attract people when you have an educated workforce, when you have good schools, when you have good roads and infrastructure. And so there's only so much the tax cuts can do. At some point, you have to invest in your people. And then that's, I think, what's going to bring people in and make Louisiana the kind of place where people want to move.
Thank you, Jan. Appreciate your time and your insights as always. Wanted to get the other side of things. We'll take a break. We come back. We're going to talk to the Principal Deputy Director of the CDC about respiratory viruses. Always a serious concern. We'll tell you what you need to know, what you need to know to keep you and your family safe. Then we'll talk to Ollie Cosell, credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans, and recap Pelicans Media Day. And, of course, the Pelicans games will be here on WWL. Back in a little bit. 7:15 now, beginning of October, or as I'm referring to it for the time being, Hot-tober. There's some weather that's down in the Caribbean that could form, could not form. They don't know, so I don't really know what to tell you other than it might rain later in the week and maybe into the weekend. That's what they're saying now, so there you go. Tonight it's the Saints Hour with Saints Executive Vice President and GM Mickey Loomis. That's at 7 o'clock every Tuesday. And voice of the Saints, Mike Haas. Mickey's perspective is always compelling and honest, and they've had some great guests like former defensive tackle, now analyst Mike Golic, Saints Super Bowl champ Jonathan Stinchcomb, former defensive end Chris Long. Saints Hour tonight at 7 here on WWL and the Saints Radio Network. Pardon me? Okay. Well, we're getting ready to talk to the Principal Deputy Director of the CDC. Fall season's underway. A lot of us have runny noses. A lot of y'all have runny noses or an unrelenting cough. That could be more than just another common cold. It might be an infection caused by the flu, or maybe COVID-19 or RSV viruses. Viruses often spike during the fall and winter when the air is cold and dry. Not that way here, but it has been dry. I know some people have been suffering with allergies and runny noses, et cetera. And with that, we welcome in Dr. Nirev Shah. Principal Deputy Director of the CDC. Good morning, Doctor. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Thanks for taking the time with us. What do people need to know about the flu, COVID-19, and RSV as we head into fall and winter?
Well, you know, fall and winter happens every year, and with it come the viruses that cause the majority of a lot of the illnesses that land people in the hospital, like the flu, like COVID, like RSV. But along with the flu season also comes the vaccines that help protect against them. And the main thing that we want folks to know is that the vaccines for all three of those are here. And the key with those vaccines is that they allow you to do more of what you like to do while risking a lot less severe illness. And so one of the things that we want folks to do is to take some time over this week, over the weekend, and go out and get your vaccines.
To be clear, when you talk about the vaccine, and I know I'm going to get some texts from people here because I got people that text in all different kinds of things. The idea behind the COVID vaccine is not to keep you from getting COVID. The idea is so that if you do get it, it's a less severe case, especially if you are in one of the higher at-risk groups. Is that accurate?
That is exactly right. That is entirely accurate. You might still get a mild case of COVID, but what the vaccines are really good at doing is preventing you from landing in the hospital. And let me give you this one statistic. Last year alone, 95% of the people who were hospitalized because of COVID did not have their vaccine. And so right there, if you want to take a look at what the vaccine is doing, it's really preventing you from landing in the hospital because your illness is that severe. Again, you might still get a mild case, but overall, the vaccine is your best defense against landing in the hospital. And that's really why we say what the vaccines do is that you risk a lot less severe illness, which then in turn allows you to do more this fall and winter holiday season.
What is it about the fall that makes these things come around? As you said, you know, we're going to fall and winter, and that's when this stuff happens.
Yeah, there's a couple of things happening that lead to this sort of seasonality. One is that we're just all together a lot more indoors, whether it's watching football games, going to family events, whatever the case may be. We're just indoors more than a lot of folks might be in the summer, for example. Another thing is that the colder, drier air makes it a lot easier for the viruses to travel a little bit further and for our bodies to be a little bit more susceptible to them. And so those factors, plus a couple of other things that are going on in the background, typically mean that around this time of year, we start to see increases in hospitalizations. And the numbers are significant. You know, last year alone, 800,000 people across the United States, 800,000 people landed in the hospital because of either flu, COVID, or RSV. But again, it doesn't have to be that way. The vaccines cut those numbers in half.
All right, Doctor, let me take a quick break for traffic. We'll pick it up here. We'll come back talking to Dr. Nirev Shah, Principal Deputy Director for the CDC, about respiratory viruses. When we come back, we'll talk about who's currently eligible to get flu, COVID-19, RSV vaccines. When should they get vaccinated? We'll talk about separating the politics from the science. Traffic now, WWL. 724, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Dr. Nirev Shah, Principal Deputy Director of the CDC. Let's talk about the politics and the science when it comes to the vaccines. Doctor, I'm just going to ask, you know, are you guys implanting chips in our brains or causing heart disease or anything like that? I hate to ask, but
We're not implanting any kind of chips. We're not causing any kind of heart disease. All we're really trying to do is to keep people from landing in the hospital. You know, last year, because of these three diseases alone, flu, COVID, and RSV, 800,000 people landed in the hospital. 70,000 people died. Getting vaccinated helps you cut those numbers of hospitalizations in half. And so our goal here is to try to keep people as safe and healthy as possible. And so when we talk about the politicization of things like vaccines, it kind of breaks my heart, because what we're really trying to do is to keep people safe and healthy. And I think of my own mother, and I want to make sure that not only is she safe, but everyone in her community is safe. And so that's why vaccines are so important.
You know, I hated to ask you that, but I know there are people listening that think that, and I guess for those that believe that kind of stuff, no explanation is going to suffice, and for those that don't, none's necessary. Anyway, who is currently eligible to get flu, COVID-19, and RSV vaccines, and when should they get vaccinated?
Great. So here's the bottom line on who should be or who's eligible. Anyone 6 months of age and older is eligible for both the flu shot and the COVID shot. Now, there's another vaccine that's out there that's only in its second year, and that's one for this other virus called RSV. And RSV tends to affect people who are older or who are very young. And it's serious. It's one of the leading causes of landing kids in the hospital every single year. And thankfully, there's a vaccine for that, particularly for folks who are older. And for that one, the RSV shot, everyone 75 and over should make sure they're getting that shot. I made sure my mom had it last year. For folks who are between the ages of 60 to 74, they should also consider getting it, particularly if they've got another health condition that would give them a tougher time with RSV. Maybe they were a smoker and their lungs are a little damaged. Maybe they've got asthma, things of that nature. The point is that virtually everyone out there is eligible for at least two, if not all three, of these vaccines, and getting them can reduce your risk of landing in the hospital by half.
Can you get all three at the same time or not?
You can. You can. You know, so for this year, I'm eligible for the flu and the COVID shot, and I'm going to probably go and get them this weekend with my family, and I plan to just get them both on Saturday. I might have a rough day on Saturday, but by Monday morning, I'll be feeling 100 back to 100% again, and I'll have just knocked it out. And I think that's what my family's going to do. So you can definitely get at least the flu and the COVID ones at the same time. You can also get the third one, the RSV, if you're eligible, but I do know that folks like to space it out. What really matters more is that you get the vaccines. If you want to do them one after another, one week at a time, that's fine. If you want to crank them all out at once, that's fine too. What really matters is that you get vaccinated rather than the schedule on which you get vaccinated. Now, you asked me a moment ago, when's the right time to go? Mm-hmm. Well, again, it's really up to you. What I've asked folks in my family to do is try to get all your shots on board by Halloween. Because that way you go into the November gatherings and holidays fully vaccinated, and you really got the best defense possible.
I got them all, and the only problem I had was a sore arm. But, you know, you get sore all the time, so it's no big deal, really. Talk, if you will, doctor, about the dangers of getting the flu or COVID-19 and RSV compared to the potential side effects of the vaccination.
Yeah, you know, let me start with the flu, because honestly, we talk about the flu like it's not a big thing. Oh, yeah, I had a little bit of the flu this weekend. And I get what people are saying when they say that. But when doctors talk about the flu, they're talking about something different. They're talking about a disease called influenza that's caused by the flu virus. And it is a serious disease. And just last year in the United States, 20,000 people died because of the flu. And when you combine that with the 50,000 who died with COVID, you get to that 70,000 or so folks who died. And when we look at in terms of people who were hospitalized, it was about 800,000 people that were hospitalized around the country because of these three diseases. One of the benefits of vaccines is that it allows you to cut that hospitalization risk in half. So imagine that, something that takes you and your family all of a couple of minutes, maybe a half hour in the morning to go get done, your vaccines, can reduce your risk of landing in the hospital by half. Now, one of the things I want to ask folks in Louisiana to do is to get vaccinated at a higher rate than last year. Last year, only about 14% of folks in Louisiana got their COVID shots. With flu shots, it was a little better. It was about 36%. But the higher we drive those numbers, the lower likelihood there will be that folks land in the hospital.
Is there a site where people can go, doctor, to get more information?
Yes, please. The best website to go to for more information about all three of these vaccines and for locations where you can find a shot is vaccines.gov. Again, that's vaccines, plural, .gov.
And vaccine spelled with two C's, just to be clear. Thank you, doctor. Appreciate your time. Dr. Nirev Shah, Principal Deputy Director of the CDC, giving you the information hopefully you need to keep you out of the hospital. You can go to vaccines.gov. We'll talk to Ollie Cosell about the Pelicans when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. 7:44, 16 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, as you just heard. Of course, I hope you know by now, WWL is your station for your New Orleans Pelicans, here to help talk about Media Day yesterday and the season upcoming and preseason and the new team and so forth. Ollie Cosell, credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans. How you doing, Ollie?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm okay, sir. Tell me about Media Day yesterday.
Well, the biggest things were everybody wanted to see if Zion was truly fit, and he looked as good as we've ever seen him. He also talked about, you know, just doing things the right way. We've always talked about his professionalism being a problem, and he seemed to check all the boxes. But I think another big thing was looking at Brandon Ingram, seeing what he had to say. Mm-hmm. As we know, his name was mentioned in trade rumors now for the last three or so months. He still remains a Pelican, and he seemed pretty upfront about it. He said that, yes, he's going to play out his last year. He's likely not going to get an extension or sign one. A new contract with the Pelicans, doesn't think that both sides will come to an agreement. And he says he doesn't know what the future holds, whether he's going to sign his next contract either with the Pels or on another team. So he's, like I said, very upfront and just honestly not towing any kind of company lines. But again, you weren't too worried about him being a disruption, right? Usually when players are at the end of the deal or not getting what they want, it can be disruption. But he put that to bed. David Griffin did as well. So it doesn't seem like there's going to be those type of issues. And lastly, the thing that stood out was Willie Green, of course, everybody else talking about how much they're going to play smaller this year, right? They don't have a true center, so to speak, one that's been a starter for a long time, like Jonas Valanciunas, who just left. They signed Daniel Theis. And Willie said, look, I'm going to play small. There's going to be a lot of games this year, tons of games. I think he actually said, well, I'm not even going to have a traditional center playing any minutes. So Pelicans seem very dedicated to playing small. We'll see how that goes.
So for those of us that aren't huge basketball fans, explain what that means, playing small.
Traditionally there's obviously there's five players on the court at all times. One of those positions is always named a center. And the range basically for a center, starting center, is typically between, 6'10" to anywhere over 7 feet. And usually this player weighs at least 250 pounds. Well, the Pelicans had that guy last year, like I said, Jonas Valanciunas. This year, Daniel Theis, he's 6'8", weighs probably about 240 pounds. Behind him, Carlo Matkovic, who's a rookie. And he's basically in the mold of like Larry Nance, right? About same height, same size, same kind of vertical ability. So he's not a traditional center. And then the player that the Pelicans drafted over the summer, Eve Messi, right? But he's a raw rookie out of Baylor. He's only 19, barely played basketball in his career, so you can't expect him, even though he meets the size specifications, he's likely going to need the whole year probably, you know, training, working with developmental staff. So, yeah, the Pelicans don't have that traditional center.
I found it interesting what Brandon Ingram was saying about listening to his family and so forth. Talk about that a little bit, if you would.
Yeah, it seemed like he needed to find some kind of peace, right, with everything that happened last year. And he told us, right, at the conclusion of the year, he had his worst season ever in New Orleans, right? And it started back with the FIBA tournament all the way through the season, the disappointments in the playoffs. And he said it was a tough year, by far my worst. And then, of course, not getting a contract, the one he probably wanted or expected from either the Pelicans or somebody else. So he had to find some kind of, like I said, harmony, escape. And he said he just basically went back to, you know, being around his family the way he used to be, to where he didn't want to meet other people's, not so much expectations, but doing what they basically asked of him, right? He just went back to being the person that wants and does what he wants to do. And so he says he kind of took that mindset where he's just living for himself. And apparently, like I said, he looked awfully comfortable, even on the podium. We're talking about these uncomfortable subjects, and he's a guy that usually doesn't even like talking to media. Mm-hmm. He seemed at peace. So that gives me hope that at least if this is his final year, Tommy, I think he's going to get through it. He's not going to be a guy going hog wild for his own shots because he's trying to earn a new contract, mm-hmm. where he's hurting the team's chances out there for wins and stuff because he's, you know, for selfish motivations. I think he's got a good mindset to where he's just going to do what's required of him. We'll see what that means, though.
What'd you see from Zion?
Yeah, like I said, body looks fantastic. I don't think we even saw him looking like this when he first came out of Duke. So there was that. There was also the way he was talking. He, you know, in the past was a lot more jovial, joking with us, not being as serious, right? Even though some of the questions were serious in the past. But yesterday it was all business. He just really wants to win. He thinks he can become one of the leaders of the team. And he just pointed to, you know, being excited about there's more talent than we've ever seen on this team. Talked about DeJounte. And he was up front, too, about, you know, Pelicans not having a true center. He's like, yeah, that's actually an issue, right? We don't have one. So we'll find out real quickly whether we can play with as we're currently constructed with other teams and compete very well or not. So, no, I like his matter-of-factness. Like I said, his professionalism shined. And it's something we've been waiting for, and it's now happening in year 6.
Right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Got any questions, comments about the Pels? 504-260-1870. We'll pick it up with Ollie Cosell, a credentialed NBA writer who covers the Pelicans when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. 7:55 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking Ollie Cosell, credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans, of course, WWL. They have all the Pelican games this year. Let's talk about DeJounte Murray. What did he have to say yesterday, and how much better are the Pelicans likely to be since we have him?
Yeah, that was probably how I've seen the way Zion's conditioning level was at and his professionalism. You were most excited to see exactly what DeJounte Murray is going to bring. Of course, we haven't seen him play basketball yet on the court, but he has a following or a known quantity of being a guy who's kind of an alpha. And that was the term that was used a lot yesterday. Pelicans needed a leader, especially in clutch time minutes last season. They threw away so many potential wins, and they saw that clearly as an issue. That's why they really wanted to add a point guard. And DeJounte Murray really fits the bill. He is a guy that can play on both ends of the court, right? He was known as being one of the best defenders when he was with San Antonio Spurs. That slipped over the last few years while with the Atlanta Hawks. But again, that's kind of what happens when you go to bad teams, kind of dysfunctional teams. You don't play up to your full potential for whatever reason. But now the Pelicans have another defender again in the starting lineup. But also more importantly, they've got that playmaker, Tommy. And he's also going to be a good rebounder, right? There's some that say, hey, he can average anywhere between probably 7-8 rebounds a game, probably 8 or 9 assists. Give you the type of production I think we haven't seen here in a long time, right? Lonzo Ball, he was able to rack up the assists a lot, get you some rebounds, but he wasn't a good scorer, and he was a so-so defender. DeJounte Murray's a step above that. In fact, I think Pelicans haven't had a point guard this good since Jrue Holiday. So that's going to make waves, I think, in their offensive production. Last season, offense was the weaker of the two sides. And especially, like I said, closing out games, those close games, they couldn't do it. I think DeJounte Murray is going to be able to unlock that.
What's a reasonable expectation for the Pelicans this season, in your opinion?
Yeah, see, that's tough, right? How are they going to fare against Nikola Jokic, like of the Denver Nuggets? All these teams that have the bigs, Joel Embiid with the Philadelphia Sixers. Mm-hmm. Are they going to get crushed by, say, 10, 15 rebounds on the glass, and of course then give up too many easy buckets on the inside because they're so small? Or will they be able to overcome it a lot like the Oklahoma City Thunder were able to last season? They were a team that was known to play a lot smaller than the competition, gave up more rebounds to their opponents, but they still found ways to win because they did a lot of other things well, shooting the ball well, causing a lot of turnovers, and of course having stellar point guard play with Shai Gilgeous. Now the Pelicans have a much better point guard, and they look like they're well-suited to run. They've got some of the best, longest wings, right, as a group, right? Brandon Ingram, Zion, you know, but Trey Murphy, Herb Jones. So the expectation is they're going to be versatile enough and be able to play small to where they're going to do a lot of things better on the court. And if they can do that, then there's no reason why, honestly, if they stay healthy, reasonably healthy, get to 50 wins or more. But if, like I said, if they don't really shine in all these other departments and then really get beaten up on the boards, well, they'll probably end up with, you know, a lower win total than last year's 49.
And real quick, tell me about training camp.
Yeah, so that starts today. They're going to be up in Nashville working out at Belmont University, and they'll stay there through Sunday. And then they're going to come back Monday, play their first preseason game against Orlando Magic. It's a weird timing, right? They play 12:30 in the afternoon. Not sure how many people are going to be able to attend that on Monday, but we're going to find out a lot of questions are going to be getting answered. Who's going to be in the rotation? How are they going to be able to play small? And if they can, who's going to be those faces during training camp? Because Willie's got to figure out his rotation.
Thank you. Appreciate your time, Ollie, as always. Ollie Cosell, credentialed NBA writer, covering the Pelicans. All the games could be here on WWL. It's going to be interesting to watch that season unfold. I'm excited about it. I really am, especially with DeJounte Murray. We'll see what happens. When we come back, we'll talk to Steve Geller, WWL sports director, about the Saints. 8:15 now, Steve Geller joins us, WWL sports director. How you doing, Steve Geller?
Hanging in there, Tommy. How you doing today?
Yeah, that's all you can do. We've seen that script before play out, and unfortunately it played out Sunday in Atlanta. Let's start with injuries.
Yeah, that's been a major, you know, black mark on this team. All the injuries seem to be piling up now. We're just four games into the season, but so many key guys were banged up for that matchup, and one of them was Taysom Hill, who came back and played in the game in Atlanta, but couldn't finish it out after scoring two touchdowns. Dennis Allen did say it was a rib injury, but we do not know the extent of it, if they're fractured, what exactly is going on with Taysom. He wouldn't address that, the head coach, yesterday when he addressed the media, saying that the first injury report for this week will come out on Thursday because they are playing on Monday Night Football. So it's kind of a hold your breath and wait and see what the deal on Taysom Hill is. But some of the other guys, obviously we know the offensive line's dealing with injury. Eric McCoy is on injured reserve. Cesar Ruiz dealing with a knee issue. He was out last game. We'll have to wait to find out his status going into this matchup against the Chiefs. On a bright note, at least the offensive line held together pretty well in that Atlanta game, considering that they were lacking two of their main guys, the two of their best guys on that roster, doing a patchwork job trying to fill things in there. But then you had a guy like Alvin Kamara, your star running back, dealing with hip and ribs, and some of the reports were saying that Alvin actually played with broken ribs in that game, which is pretty amazing. We'll find out more of his status, too, going forward. DeMario Davis, another big star name for your team, dealt with a hamstring issue, missed the first game of his illustrious career. COVID kept him out of one, but this was because of injury this past week in Atlanta. We'll see if he's able to get back in action for the team. And then in-game, also, a guy like Tyrann Mathieu was dealing with some things, being banged up, and it just seemed a groin injury popped up for him in the game in Atlanta. We don't know anything more about his status going forward, too. So like I was saying, a lot of your top-tier names that are main key contributors are just hurting right now, and I think the Who Dat Nation, obviously, hurting right now after a fantastic 2-0 start and then dropping really two nail-biters back-to-back that, and all in all seriousness, you look at it, and this team could be legitimately, woulda, coulda, shoulda, be 4-0 right now.
Yeah, but, you know, I guess I'm trying to just be realistic here. If you'd have looked at the schedule before the season and said, okay, I'll tell you what, you can be 2-2 right now, you'd have taken it, huh?
Yeah, I think a lot of folks' perception of the team was down going into the year, so like you mentioned, 2-2 at this point doesn't seem like the world is ending. The sky is falling. It just kind of smacked you back into reality after that dream first start to the season where the Saints rolled over the Panthers and the Cowboys, and it just seemed like, obviously, Clint Kubiak in this offense was the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Tell me about that. What is real? What's the illusion? Or is it a combination of both? Because in the first 2 weeks, it might have been not necessarily an illusion, but real. But then you get your schemes on tape, and then defenses start to adjust to that. That factors into this?
I think, obviously, you know, team gets the tape on you, comes up be a factor. But the biggest one for me, and you hate to use, you know, obviously injuries and excuses, but when I don't really know who is your depth behind Alvin Kamara. He's getting, I feel like, way overused in this offense. And the guy's looking for a new contract for this team, fighting every inch for your squad, looking to get paid this offseason. But like Jamal Williams, I'm really not clear on his role in the team. I figured he'd be your banger up close on that offensive line, being able to get those tough yards. It seems to be behind Kamara, it's Taysom Hill to get you that tough yardage. We are getting reports Kendre Miller could be coming off injured reserve this week, but Dennis Allen didn't want to speculate too far in advance with that either. Your wide receiver core, Chris Olave, dealing with a hamstring issue, I didn't mention him, seemed to kind of re-aggravate that towards the end of last game against the Falcons, so that's going to be another concern going forward. And your lack of production, too, for me, from the tight end position. Juwan Johnson, Foster Moreau haven't really been contributing that much. Once again, you look at it and you're like, well, Taysom Hill's the guy. Right now it looks like if Alvin and Taysom aren't out there, the struggles for this offense are a heck of a lot greater. And obviously none of your starting all-pro center and an Eric McCoy hurts. I didn't think the communication or the line was that much of an issue. The last game, it'll be a heck of a lot different I hate to say it, I can't believe I'm going to say it, going against the Steve Spagnuolo defense in Kansas City.
Yep, let's take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. 504-260-187. You got any questions or comments? Talking to Steve Geller, WWL sports reporter. Saints taking on the Chiefs Monday night, 8:20. Traffic now, WWL. 8:25 and a half. Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with our friend Steve Geller, WWL sports director. Talking about the Saints, the injury situation. Alvin Kamara, you know, back before the season started, there was a whole Alvin Kamara, Christian McCaffrey comparison, durability, etc.
Yeah.
Last time I checked, Alvin Kamara was playing his rear end off with broken ribs, and Christian McCaffrey's in Germany. Is there any, I don't know what's going on between Alvin Kamara and the Saints. Lord knows, I don't know what else you could ask of number 41 than what he's given you. Is there any, I guess, urgency on part of the Saints to get this done, or on the part of Alvin Kamara? Where does that whole thing stand, Steve?
You know, Tommy, yeah, it doesn't seem to be any kind of urgency on the Saints' end of things. And right at the end of training camp, even Alvin was asked about it, you know, talk about his, you know, getting a new contract with the Saints. He's made it clear he wants to be here. He wants to stay in New Orleans. He loves his team, loves the city. And obviously, like you said, has done everything to show that he's willing to play through the nicks and bruises, and those are pretty extreme bruises too when it's, you're saying that it's busted ribs. But he mentioned the fact that it's too late now. You know, he's going into this season, he doesn't want to deal with contract negotiations, him or his team, with the season going on right now. So I'm assuming there's not going to be any kind of negotiations between the front office and his agents until after the year. And it just seems, I guess, that 29-year-old running back, the team's concerned with, you know, doling out that money to. You mentioned the Christian McCaffrey right now. Shoot, we haven't seen him this entire season. It wasn't believed to be that serious of an injury. Now you mentioned he's in Germany, for crying out loud, getting a second, third assessment of what he's dealing with right now. And the San Francisco 49ers finding a way to move on without that. It's a tough situation for running backs in this league, trying to get paid. Especially when you get that 29-year mark, it just seems to be this wall that folks consider when the big drop-off seems to happen because of the use and abuse they go through.
Yeah, you know, I get this great movie, North Dallas 40, and I got a scene where a guy says, every time I say it's a business, you say it's a game. Every time I say it's a game, you say it's a business, right? And it seems like, I understand that it's a business, but this guy is playing his heart out for you, giving you everything that he has, and it just seems like, man, I don't know. They need to take care of Alvin Kamara. I don't know what else you could ask out of a guy. Let's talk about the Saints' defense. What happened with Cam Jordan? Where's he at?
Yeah, Cam's usage has really been down this season. Unfortunately, they, you know, you talk about good old father time is undefeated, and Cam just doesn't seem to have that burst anymore to be able to get out to the quarterback. There was hope that maybe this game, you know, reigniting some of those old fire against the Atlanta Falcons, where he's dominated and been able to obviously sack Matt Ryan a ton. Maybe a guy like Kirk Cousins, who is not mobile whatsoever, with concrete feet, you'd be able to get to. Cam's usage, though, his snaps are down along this D-line and has not really been a factor. I figure at least he's someone that could be a contributor in the run game without having that pass rush, you know, speed and burst quite the same anymore. But it was really surprising to see with that, you know, your guy like a Carl Granderson and a Chase Young, nobody really able to get after the Falcons quarterback, who I thought was going to be, you know, prime for the picking, coming back from an Achilles surgery, and the Falcons O-line was dealing with injury issues of their own with no their starting center or tackle. Storm Norton was starting for them, a guy that was on the Saints practice squad a year ago. So it was something that you thought this team would take advantage of, but for whatever reason, the pass rush numbers as a whole really seemed to have dipped the last couple of games. It looked like they were going to be a pretty good dominant force compared to last year in the early goings, but for whatever reason, they're not hitting home of late, and even just getting to the quarterback to create that pressure hasn't been there. I felt like Kirk Cousins, way too many times, he was poised back there too much time.
Agreed, totally agree. Here we are. We'll talk to you again before the Kansas City game on Monday night, but here we are, fourth of the season, just about already gone, man, flying by. October, and next up, Chiefs on Monday night. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Tommy.
You bet. Pleasure as always. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk about the National Fried Chicken Festival. Right now, we pause for WWL First News. 8:46, 14 till 9. Now, Fried Chicken Festival started in 2016, and it has grown exponentially since then. It's a two-day outdoor festival that brings together hundreds of thousands of people from across the nation around a shared love of great food, fried chicken. You can't go wrong with that, right? Music and culture. Last fall, that festival attracted a record-breaking 123,000 attendees from across Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Texas, and the entire United States to celebrate and enjoy the iconic Southern dish, earning the Fried Chicken Festival the number 6 spot on the USA Today 10 Best Readers' Choice Awards list of top specialty food festivals. It's back this year, Fried Chicken Festival 2024, with all the things that we love, and we're going to talk more about it right now with Ellie Schmidt, the Director of Event Marketing for the National Fried Chicken Festival. How you doing, Ellie?
Hi, I'm great. How are you?
I was just talking about how big the event got from 2016, moving up to number 6 on what, USA Today's list of festivals?
Yeah, we were super excited. We were ranked 6 out of 10 on their top 10 best specialty food festivals in the country this year. So really, really proud of that.
So let's start with, when is it and where is it?
Yeah, so it's going to be this weekend out on the lakefront. This will be our third year in that location. And we're really excited. People have really been loving it. I mean, you can't ask for a more, you know, scenic backdrop than the lake. So we'll be out there Saturday and Sunday from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m.
So the lakefront's a pretty big place. You're talking about where at now?
Yeah, so we're actually at on Lakeshore Drive, right at the intersection of Franklin Avenue. It's right behind the UNO Lakefront Arena.
Okay.
So we'll have free parking at the UNO Lakefront Arena, and then people can just, you know, walk right across to the festival site.
I think that'd be where the Pope said Mass, isn't it? Same place?
Yeah, yes.
For reference purposes?
Yes, when we first activated in that space, it had been so long since there had ever been any kind of large-scale event there, and that was the first thing that people thought of. So, yeah, we're excited to kind of showcase how beautiful that area is and bring people out there.
Maybe that had something to do with the success. Tell me about what people can look forward to.
Yeah, so this year we're going to have over 40 participating restaurants serving all kinds of fried chicken, and not just fried chicken, but we're also going to have pescatarian options, vegan options, vegetarian options, gluten-free options. So, you know, we think everyone loves fried chicken, but there are a few here and there that don't. So, you know, no matter what you like to eat, we'll have something out there for everyone to enjoy. We've got a really great music lineup this year. We've got Bun B, Better Than Ezra, Shamar Allen, Teacher Moses, and then we had a performance with Choppa scheduled, but as y'all know, tragically, he got in a pretty serious accident last weekend. So we have some awesome artists who have kind of stepped up to fill in and do a Friends of Choppa showcase performance. That's going to be DJ Jubilee, Hot Boy Ronald, and a few others on Sunday evening.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up here. We'll come back. We're talking to Ellie Schmidt, Director of Event Marketing for the National Fried Chicken Festival. Happens this weekend, the 5th and the 6th. That would be behind UNO Lakefront Arena where, you know, years ago the Pope said Mass. If that helps you as a reference point, we'll talk more about it when we come back. Right now it's time for traffic on WWL. 8:54, 6 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about one of the best festivals that happens in the area, the Fried Chicken Festival, with Ellie Schmidt, Director of Event Marketing for the National Fried Chicken Festival. Happens October 5th, this Saturday and Sunday, out at the Lakefront Arena, where the Pope said Mass. Parking is where? At the Lakefront Arena grounds, Ellie?
Yep, we'll have free parking at the Lakefront Arena, and then anyone that wants to get dropped off or picked up via Uber or Lyft can get dropped off at the east entrance, and that's going to be on Lakeshore Drive.
Tell me about the ticketing options.
Yeah, so this year, I mean, we have a pretty affordable festival. We have a general admission ticket that's just $20 that gets you access to the festival. And then this year, we're also excited to kind of introduce some reimagined VIP offerings for those who are 21 and up. Mm-hmm. We have a multi-lounge VIP pass that will get you into both VIP lounges located at each of our music stages. That comes with three free drinks. That comes with an award-winning fried chicken meal from either Gus's or Chicken's Kitchen. Mm-hmm. And then we also have an unlimited beer garden area that's also another 21-plus option for those people that, you know, love beer. And, you know, if you want to bring the family, just get the regular GA ticket, and we'll have all kinds of stuff out there to do for the kiddos. We have a kids tent with story time with Disney characters, face painting, and all kinds of fun activities. So whether you want a day away from the kids or you want to bring them with you, we'll have something for everyone out there.
You also got some cars, right? Classic cars and bikes?
We do. We're excited to be bringing back our Car Corral showcase this year. So along the lakefront, along Lakeshore Drive, we'll have all kinds of custom cars, bikes, from across the Gulf South on display for people to come check out as well.
Tell me about the awards.
Yeah, so this year we're introducing our first ever People's Choice Award. So this will be the first time that the public actually has an opportunity to vote on their favorites. We're excited that two of our vendors, Chicken's Kitchen and Picnic Provisions and Whiskey, they just made it to the final two of NOLA.com's Best Fried Chicken in the City Award. So we're excited to settle that once and for all this weekend to see who really comes out on top. And then we'll have a Best Fried Chicken Sandwich Award, like an overall Best Fried Chicken Award, Best Use of Chicken in a Dish Award, and then we'll be presenting a Culinary Icon Award to a local chef as well.
So, for people that are listening and they're saying, Ellie, because, you know, that's your name, Ellie, how much difference can there be in fried chicken? You would tell them?
A whole lot. We have got fried chicken flavors from all over the world. This year, we're excited to introduce Lufu Nola. That's our first time we've had an Indian vendor. We'll be serving Indian fried chicken. But whether you like it spicy, whether you like it mild, you know, truly you'll be surprised at how many spins we can put on fried chicken when you come out there and start looking at all the menu boards. So,
and this started in Lafayette Park, did it not?
It did in 2016. That was the first one ever. And for those that were there, you might remember, I think we ran out of chicken very, very quickly. We were overwhelmed at the amount of success that first festival had and how many people really do love fried chicken in this city and kind of what it means to everyone and what it means to our food culture. So we expanded pretty rapidly the next year over at Waldenburg Park, and then we kind of outgrew that location as well. So this new venue out at the lakefront really gives us a lot more space. It's more scenic. It's easier to get there, you know, to park your car. So we've had a lot of good feedback from people since we made that switch a couple years ago.
And I don't know what's going to happen with the weather because I don't know if they know. Ellie, they talk about this stuff in the Gulf and they say, it might rain, might not rain, might develop, might not develop. So either way, the festival goes on, rain or shine, correct?
We are rain or shine. We're obviously monitoring the weather very closely. And if it is something serious, you know, that's a call we'll make here in the next few days. But as of right now, everything is scheduled to go on as planned. So we're super excited to see everyone down there.
And real quick, what can you bring or not bring? I know you don't have time to run through everything, what's prohibited, but generally speaking.
Yeah, so no outside food or drink. That's a big one. No cash. The festival is fully cashless. You can bring, you know, strollers for your kids. You can bring backpacks. You know, you can bring all the standard festival stuff. No big tents, no large beach umbrellas, anything like that. But really, you know, just use common sense. But all that information and tickets are available on our website at friedchickenfestival.com.
And no pets other than service animals, correct?
No pets other than service animals. Right. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Ellie. Appreciate your time. Ellie Schmidt, Director of the Event Marketing for the National Fried Chicken Festival. All you have to do is go to friedchickenfestival.com. You can find out everything you need to know. We come back, we're going to talk about hurricanes and insurance and more here on WWL. All right, 909 here. We're joined by Ben Keys, who rejoins us. He was on earlier, and I forgot exactly when it was, Ben, but it's good to have you back, Professor of Real Estate and Finance at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back. Hope you're doing well.
Yes, sir, I am. You know, it seems like a year ago that Hurricane Beryl hit Texas, although it was July earlier in hurricane season. We're later in hurricane season, a lot of activity in the Atlantic. Thankfully, none of it threatening any of us. As it stands now, there is this system in the Gulf that they're watching. They don't know what could turn up with that. And of course, we had Helene that just spun up and devastated a lot of the country. And as I was looking at that, Ben, I was thinking, you know, people after Katrina were saying, and to be clear, Katrina was a failure of the levee system, not necessarily the storm, because the storm missed New Orleans, it hit Mississippi. People would say, you know, that, well, maybe you shouldn't live there. And as I was watching the track of Helene and the damage that it caused, I don't know that that's an argument anymore when you look at, say, places like Asheville or areas of North Carolina that are, what, 2,000 feet up and 300 miles inland, right?
Yeah, and I mean, as a place to start, it's, you know, the footage from that area is just heartbreaking. You know, I think that it is this idea that that there's somewhere that is immune to our changing climate is just a myth. You know, we're seeing warmer temperatures in the Gulf, and that's leading to different types of storms, which can take this type of form, which you know, end up moving very slowly and dropping enormous amounts of rain. And, you know, it was a very similar experience all the way up in Vermont last year with a tremendous amount of flooding there. Again, you know, many miles inland up in the mountains in New England, areas that have been promoted as being sort of climate safe, you know, places to move to or places to retire to. And I think it's just going to take a big shift in how we think about the nature of these risks, which is that no one's immune, and that every community and every, you know, individual needs to have the right amount of protection when it comes to insurance and when it comes to building up infrastructure and resilience.
I think I might have said this last time, but when it comes to, you know, science and politics, they never get along. And when I try to decide what's real and what's not, I look to the military, I look to science, and I look to Wall Street, because that'll pretty well tell you what's happening, or big business, right? What's real and what's not. And let me get off my soapbox here, and then you can talk. When it comes to insurance, it's all based on, the model of insurance is based on, the people that don't claim anything pay for the people that do. And that's how insurance companies stay in business. It's actuarial tables. And the problem is, when they have to pay out more than they take in, somebody's got to make up that difference. The insurance model is based on people that don't make claims on the insurance, paying premiums and that cover the claims for the people that do. I'm presenting that terribly clumsy, because you know why, Ben? I didn't go to the Wharton School of Business. But am I close there with what I'm trying to stumble through?
You've got it. Yes. You know, an insurance, and this is what I've been studying in a lot of detail these last few years, is looking at connections between climate change and then insurance, mortgage, and housing markets. Insurance markets function because of risk pooling. And so you're going to be combining a lot of people under the same provider of insurance. The expectation is that not everyone in that risk pool will be harmed by a risk over, say, a given calendar year, and essentially you're able to transfer the claims from those who were affected to those who weren't. I think intuitively it may work with the best when we're thinking about something like an auto insurance policy, where, you know, car accidents are idiosyncratic, and, you know, if someone that you know is an fender bender, you know, their claims to get their car repaired are going to come out of the premiums that you and I, who might not have been in an accident that year, are going to pay in. And so that's how the system has to work, is you need enough of a risk pool that's shared across, you know, a range of probabilities, like you alluded to, actuarial tables, that's going to provide enough diversification for the insurance company to do their job. And also, at the end of the day, these are for-profit companies that are looking to turn a profit at the end of the day. So they do want the premiums to be, you know, greater than the claims they pay out.
So that being said, there is not a doubt that the climate is changing, is there?
That's right. That's right. There's really no question, and it's a scientific certainty at this point, and we're seeing it in a variety of different ways, whether that's droughts that are leading to more wildfires, whether that's the intensity of hurricanes, whether it's rising sea levels, and there's really no question there. You know, I'm an economist by training. I'm not a climate scientist, mm-hmm. But I read the climate literature quite closely, and I talk with people in. You know, as you were saying, like, you know, look to those who you trust.
Yep.
When you look to the U.S. military and the reports that have been put out year after year about how they are reconsidering the location of many bases and investing heavily in infrastructure on coastal bases, they are very transparent that this is because of a changing climate. And when you talk to the insurance and reinsurance industry, they make this point over and over again, which is, you know, look, the disaster risks that we face are simply different than they were 20 or 25 years ago.
And I'm not saying that big business will never lie to you. I'm saying that when it comes to their operations, you can look to that to see what the truth is and what the realities are and what the realities are not. Accurate?
Yeah. I mean, I think at the end of the day, they have to put their money where their mouth is. The insureds and reinsurance businesses are really in this first loss position when a disaster occurs. And so they're very sensitive to the realities on the ground. And that means they've invested, you know, billions of dollars in data collection, in climate modeling, and to really understand the changing nature of catastrophes related to climate.
So when it comes to hurricanes, you know, they make these predictions, and then we always gauge it here by, you know, well, if we were affected by when we had, what was the one we were here for, Tim? I forgot the name of it that we stayed overnight for, the hurricane. Do you remember? Francine, was it? I think, yeah. I get them confused because we're here, you know, 48 hours without sleep, and it all runs together. But we did have one that impacted the area. Thankfully, it was not to those that didn't have any damage. It wasn't that serious. But then we go to the predictions, and we say, well, maybe they didn't pan out. But when you look at all of the named storms that some of them out in the Atlantic, like right now, it does pan out. But the point I'm trying to make here, I guess, Ben, is that when you look at a storm, and the impacts all the way through North Carolina, that affects the reinsurance market or not?
Absolutely. It affects insurers and reinsurers. You know, the aftermath of these disasters is an enormous challenge for the communities on the ground as they attempt to rebuild their communities and rebuild their lives. And, you know, a really important player in that rebuilding process are the insurance companies who, you know, are then assessing the damage and paying out claims. And when there's a very large volume of those claims, that's going to potentially impair some insurance companies who may not have had enough of a cushion of as you were, we were talking about the risk pool, right? Enough of other premiums or a sort of, you know, savings account, capital pile to pay out those claims. We've seen a number of insurers fail, especially in the Florida market in the last couple of years. They're also going to lean on the reinsurance market. And reinsurance is essentially insurance for insurance companies. Insurance companies are worried about staying solvent. And so for certain types of disasters, they're going to go and take out an insurance policy on the policies that they themselves are writing, and it tends to be very focused on concentrated catastrophic risk. And so they are going to be worried about a big storm hitting a major metro area. For a disaster like this recent one with Helene, the estimates are already out there that maybe only a quarter of the damage is going to be fully insured. And that's a function of undercoverage, so homeowners not having enough coverage on their property, and then the lack of take-up of flood insurance that many households around the country who are in flood, you know, potential areas but not high likelihood of flood, so outside of that 1 in 100-year floodplain, very unlikely to take up flood insurance. And so, unfortunately, flood insurance is not covered by most homeowners' policies, even up in the mountains of Asheville. And so what that means is that there are going to be a lot of people who are actually going to have substantial losses without an insurer sort of to support their recovery efforts.
So to make a radiographic, if I can, I know that seems oxymoronic, but if you take the path of Helene, if you draw a circle at the bottom there along the coast, along Florida, maybe that's who the insurance companies expected they would have to pay claims for at some point, and those are the people that they paid premiums. But all the people that are in the path beyond that paid premiums, and they were paying into the pool, and that's what the insurance companies were counting on. They were not counting on claims from people all the way up, correct?
Yeah, and it's this dual layer nature of insurance where we have, you know, most homeowners insurance in the U.S. is privately provided by these, you know, private market insurers. We are seeing a rise in these state fair plans, this kind of insurer of last resort, especially common in Florida and growing in Louisiana and elsewhere. But the flood insurance has been carved out
and that's,
of...
That's where we're going to take a break, Ben, because I wanted to bring you to flood insurance because... A lot of people are saying, well, maybe there should be a national insurance plan, a national disaster insurance plan, and do away with private homeowners insurance. Or I don't know how you would parse what's a disaster and what's not. And then I say to people when they say, well, that's what you need. Well, look how flood insurance, how is that working out for you? And mine's gone from $300 to $900 despite the improvements that the Corps of Engineers has made. So we'll talk about all of that. And then there's always the Commerce Clause and can you force people to buy insurance or can't you? There's also the federal treasury and FEMA, and if they bail people out that didn't have flood insurance, ultimately we're all paying for that one way or the other, right, from an economic standpoint?
That's right.
So it's a Rubik's Cube. We'll continue to try to turn it all around and try to put it together when we come back with Ben Keyes. I'm getting a lot of texts here from people, too, and I mentioned this on the air yesterday. It seems as though now insurance companies are calling people and telling them they're overinsured and trying to get them to drop their coverage, which I'm sorry, no disrespect to my agent, but I smell a rat when I get a call like that because I'm thinking, well, are you really trying to save me money? And if you're going to collect premiums that you won't have to pay out on, why wouldn't you do that? We'll talk more when we come back. You got any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. Ben Keyes, our guest, professor of real estate finance, University of Pennsylvania's prestigious Wharton School of Business, back in a flash on WWL. Talking to Ben Keyes, professor of real estate finance at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, and this is going to be kind of complicated. I'm trying not to go all over the place too much, but I want to get you texted in also at 504-260-1870. Professor, let me make this statement. You can tell me if it's accurate or not. Given climate change, the current insurance model is unsustainable. Accurate or not?
I think it's close to accurate. I think, you know, we have, you know, I think insurance is a very misunderstood market in a lot of ways. It is a very heavily regulated market. Every state basically has control of the homeowners insurance market, and there isn't really a role for federal oversight. And I think, you know, that the basic model of homeowners insurance was previously very boring and was very predictable. Generally the insurance premium that you paid this year was probably something very close to the premium that you paid the year before. And I think that has changed dramatically in these last few years. My research has shown a 34% increase nationwide in premiums from 2020 to 2023, and substantially higher increases than that in higher risk parts of the country, like where most of your listeners are. And so, you know, I think that creates a level of uncertainty around the cost of living in an area that just simply wasn't the case even a few years ago. And I think that is going to push us to rethink how we regulate and how we structure insurance contracts, whether we need long-term insurance contracts, whether we need community-level insurance contracts, and then, as you alluded to before, whether we need something that looks more like a public-private partnership to defray some of the costs, these rising costs of insurance.
And to be clear, when I say unsustainable, it's like, and I always quote this example of a contractor, telling you, we can do anything you want if you have the money. So if you keep raising premiums, right, I mean, you can sustain it all you want. However, from the economic standpoint, there's only a limited amount of money or that people can pay in some instances or in a lot of instances.
Exactly, and I think that's the tension in the market right now, which is as insurers raise their premiums, they're not just they're partly trying to signal the risk. So part of what insurers can do is on an annual basis, they can raise your premiums to say this is reflective of what we believe the appropriate amount of risk is. And they're, again, alluding back to your actuarial tables, they're trying to price things in a way that is actuarially fair and consistent. So it's communicating information to homeowners when you see those premiums go up. But at the same time, it is having a direct effect on households' bank accounts. It's having a direct effect on their pocketbooks. And what that means is that households are going to have to adjust. And so some of that is going to be shopping around for a different insurance provider. Some of that might be taking on less insurance and having less coverage. And in some very unfortunate cases, it means dropping coverage altogether because you're just priced out of the market. And, you know, in that case, the insurance companies are fine. They can go and operate elsewhere. But the amount of risk in, you know, that for that household or that community is unchanged. And so in many ways, they're more exposed. And so I think that's one of the real tensions when you have, you know, insurance premiums increasing so rapidly is that it is putting a lot of households in a very tough spot where they're going to have to make hard choices about, you know, how much coverage can I afford?
And that brings us to flood insurance. I had Senator Bill Cassidy on yesterday, and he said he thinks that FEMA is trying to make up for all of the Katrina losses by raising the rates, and he did point out accurately that Katrina, as I said earlier, missed the city. Katrina hit Mississippi, and it was a failure of the flood system that caused the damage here, the federally built flood system. Along those lines, people in North Carolina didn't think they needed flood insurance. If everybody paid into the pool, then maybe that would spread out the risk. He said he has a hard time getting people in Utah and Wyoming to buy into that. So how do you, I don't know, and people are texting in about a national plan. I know, you know, the old thing used to be, if you like the post office, you'll love, no disrespect, if you like the post office, you'll love nationalized blank, right? Fill in the blank. How do you see this playing out economically? Because if the current model as it stands, given climate change, is unsustainable, I don't know what happens other than people, somebody's going to have to eat all of this money, right? If people have mortgages on homes, I don't know if you can have a mortgage on a home that's not in a flood zone, that's not covered against flood, and what happens then? The mortgage company eats it and the people walk away?
Yeah, I mean, it sadly does come down to this question of who's going to eat the losses. You know, the world is becoming a riskier place, and we've seen a dramatic increase in the number and the amount of damage that's been induced by disasters. It's basically quadrupled since the 1980s. And so what that means is that everyone needs to pay more, and it becomes a question of how are we going to share those costs? And I think you can see the perspective from a few different ways. One is we should spread the risk as widely as possible across the entire country, ideally. And in that case, that's going to drive down the costs for everybody. But at the same time, what that's going to do is it's going to cross-subsidize different parts of the country. And so people who live in a safe, cornfield community in Iowa are going to be paying into an insurance program that they probably won't benefit from, whereas coastal residents will pay a subsidized rate. And it comes back to this question of fairness. Should we be thinking about pricing risk in a way that's actuarially fair from an insurer standpoint? Like, hey, if you are a risky driver, you should pay more for your insurance. Or should we think about fairness in terms of everyone bearing some of these costs? Just to add one historical note to this, with the creation of the National Flood Insurance Program, it was sort of intentionally underpriced when it was rolled out. The idea was that they wanted to encourage take-up of this new federal program, and one way to do that is to lower the price. You basically give people a discount, and you say, hey, super cheap flood insurance, you should really take up a policy. Well, that's a great way to get people to take up. But guess what? As soon as they're on the policy, they're going to be very upset when those premiums rise. And so that program really lacked the political will to raise premiums to align with the actual costs of payouts. for decades. So they ran billions of dollars in deficits that every taxpayer in the United States were paying into. And it's only with this recent reform of risk rating 2.0 that we're seeing big changes to the pricing of that flood insurance program. And so I think this is one of the key concerns with rolling out a national program is there going to be political will to price the risk appropriately, and how much of this cross-subsidization from safer areas to risky areas do we want to do?
Subsidy or subsidization is a politically charged term, as you well know, Ben, but in essence, that's the way the insurance model works, right? People that the insurance companies deem to have minimal risk are subsidizing the people that have the higher risk? Yes? No?
Yeah, and so it becomes a question of how closely are the insurers pricing the individual's risk versus pooling everyone together and offering everyone the same rate. So if you're driving a super fancy sports car that can go 140 miles an hour and I'm driving my Honda Accord, I might not feel that it's very fair that we pay the same amount in auto insurance if you're a much riskier driver than I am. And so there's an incentive for an insurance company to come in and say, hey, we're only going to insure Honda Accords, the safe, boring dad car. And so that kind of pooling of risk is going to separate out. And what you're going to be left with is a pool of very risky drivers in one insurance company and the very safe ones in a different one. I think the challenge for a federal program like the National Flood Insurance Program is, you know, the people who buy into it are the very riskiest people. Those are the people who are expecting flood damage, whereas most of the country doesn't buy into the flood insurance program. And so they're left with this selected pool of policyholders. And I think this is one of the tensions that they face. And it means that setting rates can be quite challenging because they need to be quite high.
Again, subsidy being a politically charged word, I'm getting texts from different people saying, stop sending money overseas. Stop giving $56 billion to Ukraine. But either way, that's taxpayer money, right? One way or the other, however you look at it, it's taxpayer money, or it's money printed by the federal government that's going to go into the debt column. So I think sometimes people don't understand where the different piles of money come from. Did you say an Accord was a boring dad car?
I did. I was picking on myself.
Well, where
on
would
that
a 20, one. Where would a 2014 CRV fit into that, man? Because that's what I'm. That's my ride. Let me take a
You're
break.
You're right there.
Yeah,
You're right
I'm
there
right
with
there with you.
Then.
Yeah. Well, let me take a break. We come back. I want to talk about. And it's anecdotal, but I've gotten a lot of people that have talked to me saying, and it happened to me as well, about insurance companies calling them, contacting, saying maybe you're overinsured. Yeah, you'd like to think that when an insurance company calls you telling you, You pay me less, that something good is behind it, but I'm too cynical to believe that. We'll address that when we come back. Ben Keyes, our guest, professor of real estate and finance at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. I know somebody whose wife was an actuary, and she went to school for about 8 years to become one. So it's a very complicated art/science when it comes to predicting risk. We'll pick it up. We come back, 938, traffic now, WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Ben Keyes, professor of real estate finance at the prestigious University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. And I say that not only because our CEO went there, but because it's true. Ben, I mentioned earlier, and I don't know if this is anecdotal, I don't know if this is industry-wide or not, but insurance companies calling saying, hey, maybe you're overinsured, maybe we can drop your premium. I understand, much like a bookmaker, they're trying to lay the book off so they don't have a lot of liability on their books, but by the same token, they're not going to pay a claim for something that doesn't exist, so I'm a little confused about that.
Yeah, I'm a bit concerned about that one as well, and I haven't seen any hard data on this, but it certainly sounds exactly along the lines that you're describing as a bookmaker trying to balance the bets on either side. Similar idea is that they're trying to reduce their exposure.
Right.
I think it's important for people to shop around.
But wait, let me interrupt for 1 second, and this goes to the insurance model, and maybe it'll help us all understand this. If they're collecting a premium from me, say a $6,000 premium that could be $4,000, but yet I would have to document the damages that I had in order for them to reimburse me, well, that's all gravy on their side. Why wouldn't they continue to collect that premium?
Well, there may be other changes to the contract that they're also hoping to introduce.
It may
not just be that they're changing the premium. They may be changing the coverage. They may be asking
there
for a change in the deductible.
Okay.
There may be a change in the perils that are covered or the degree of coverage related to, are you going to replace the roof or are you going to replace the current value of the roof, right? So I think, you have to be careful in reading the fine print.
The light bulb went off, Ben Keys. You lit the bulb for me. You did.
I'm happy to hear it. I think there's I think a lack of shopping around in homeowners insurance markets. There's a reason why so many TV commercials are Flo from Progressive or Jake from State Farm or all of our other TV personality friends. I think that most people are not shopping around very aggressively. And so what the insurance companies know is that if you lock it in at one point, maybe when you're buying a house or when you refinance a mortgage, you're likely to just automatically renew it year after year. And it becomes something that is, from the insurance company's perspective, almost like a bond, like that predictable in terms of their income, their cash flow. And I don't think people realize just how much dispersion there is in the offers that you receive. If you shop around, you might find very different prices from a very different insurance company for the exact same policy. Again, with that caveat, you have to read the fine print to make sure that it's covering, the same amounts. The other piece is that in many states, insurance premiums are tied to credit scores. And so if you have seen your credit score improve over the last year or so, you should absolutely shop around for a lower rate.
Are there comparisons to be made? Well, wait, let me check that question because I want to get this one in first. When it comes to homeowners and flood being merged into one or requiring all homeowners to carry flood insurance, could that be done through federal law by mortgage regulation, or is that a state thing or what?
So regulation of the insurance industry is almost entirely at the state level. Mm-hmm. You could imagine an entity like Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac requiring additional coverage. My sense is that they are enforcing insurance requirements more stringently than they have in the past, given the frequency of disasters in the last few years. So you could see kind of a federal policy come down through the mortgage market. But generally, that would be on a state-by-state basis, as with most things in insurance regulation.
And I ask that because, the flood insurance program, FEMA, runs public service announcements. You might remember the little dachshund floating on the pillow or whatever it was, saying everybody should have flood insurance. However, not everybody's buying into that, and that's why there's the hole in the flood insurance program that there is, and that people in Louisiana and affected states are trying to look into 2.0 and say what's the methodology behind it, et cetera. That being said, are there comparisons to be made between this and health insurance for people that here's the thing. If you don't have flood insurance and you get flooded out, you're going to use all of your assets, and then at that point you go on the federal dole, right, or you go on the state dole. When it comes to health insurance, if you don't have insurance, you're going to go to the emergency room or you're going to spend all of your assets, and then you'll go on Medicaid or Medicare, what have you, and then you'll be at the mercy of the state, and they'll be providing coverage if taxpayers pick it up. Are there comparisons to be made between these two in an argument for or against national insurance either way?
I think so. I think it's a nice point, and there's clearly a need for government backstops in this space, just like we don't think it's appropriate for anyone to be without healthcare insurance. It is also, appropriate to create programs to protect homeowners when the private market refuses to offer them policies. And so I think that is, there's a very clear parallel there to some of the markets that have been set up in recent years, thanks to Obamacare, that I think parallels some of the state fair plans, quite closely, actually, in terms of the benefits there. I think there is also this broader issue in thinking about the costs of being uninsured or underinsured and the ripple effects that can have both for households and for thinking about a government's balance sheet. And, you know, in many cases, you know, this is the old adage, right? It's a stitch in time to get people insurance up front, and that can help them in so many ways rather than the ripple effects on the back end and the kind of spiral that people can suffer through. I've been doing some research on the Federal Disaster Loan Program, which is a program that offers loans through the Small Business Administration to both businesses and households in the aftermath of a disaster. And we're finding that that loan program has big beneficial effects for those who receive the loans. They're less likely to, I think the number we find is about 60% less likely to file for bankruptcy over the next 3.5 years. So, you know, there's sort of big, longer-term benefits in it, and it points to the sort of addressing people's upfront needs and worrying about it more on the front end rather than backloading it and saying we'll sort this out through other aid and assistance programs, you know, potentially many years down the line.
And somebody texted in, I think it's a good point, that said there is no state without risk, and we've often had those conversations, you know, well, if it's here, it's an earthquake, or if you live there, it's a landslide, or if you live there, it could be a wildfire, tsunami, or what have you, depending on where you live. And that being said, that I don't know if that affects, again, the whole pool of ratepayers where, and with the reinsurance market, and this is where it gets very, very complicated, do we as homeowners in Louisiana wind up paying for claims made by State Farm that they write again for to protect against wildfires in the West and so forth?
Yeah, and there's been some research which points to differences in state regulation as being one of the potential drivers for that. But that's exactly, you know, to the point I was making earlier, that we are, you know, in many ways part of a giant risk pool when we have these policies and these insurance companies are trying to spread the risks across the country with the hopes that they're not all going to hit at the same time, the sort of, you know, perfect storm series of disasters around the country. And then those premiums that are collected in one part of the country are going to cover claims elsewhere. I think it's also to the point I was making about Vermont earlier that there really is no place that's immune from these our changing climate. And so it's really a matter of degrees rather than a yes or no question. And it is there are certainly places that are more vulnerable than others. And I think just, you know, to put my professor hat back on for a second, I think one of the key elements to this is how do we make the tough choices going forward, whether it's, you know, do we invest in more infrastructure, do we make households and communities more resilient, or do we find smart ways to shift some of the areas where we live and where we work away from the most vulnerable locations. And so I think there's this kind of long-term challenge that we're going to be facing and trying to balance that with the short-term of, you know, the pain to households' pocketbooks.
One incontrovertible fact is that the climate is going to continue to change, is it not, barring anything that anybody does to prevent that?
There's no question. There's no question that a warming climate is going to lead to only exacerbating these problems. We are going to see the seas continue to rise, the temperatures continue to increase, the frequency of wildfires and droughts increasing, and the damage from these storms continue to grow. We've also had about 30 or 40 years now, really, you know, going back to the popularity of air conditioning systems, where we've seen a large southern migration in the United States. We've seen people moving from north to south, and that's moving people into harm's way. There's a really nice piece with some maps in the New York Times from just, I believe it was yesterday, where Americans have been moving into disaster-prone areas, and some very nice maps that show that, you know, the population of this country is moving into more risk-prone areas, and that is amplifying this problem.
And we have to go, but real quick, 1 minute left. Does inequity of wealth have anything to do with this problem at all in a country, a disparity of wealth?
For sure, but we're an incredibly wealthy country. We have $35 trillion of home equity in the U.S., and so when we're talking about $20 billion for FEMA or $60 billion for Ukraine, as you mentioned before, we're a rich country. We can do big, important things, and this is a solvable problem if we're willing to put our minds and our money to it.
Thank you. Appreciate your time, Ben, and insight as always. We'll talk to you again soon because this is not going to change or go away. Ben Keyes, professor of real estate finance, University of Pennsylvania's prestigious Wharton School of Business. We'll take a break, come back, and talk to Newell and see what he's got for us today on WWL.